to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Skip Morris, and he'll be answering your most important questions on largemouth bass and bugs. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Skip a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Skip Morris about largemouth bass and bugs. The World Champion Bass on a Fly Fishing Tournament is held each year on a Saturday in May on the Lake Fork in East Texas. Rod, reels, lines, and flies must be made exclusively for fly fishing. The boater division is a two-man team event based upon a total weight of five fish. The non-boater division is an individual event based upon the total length of five fish, which are photographed and released. Other activities include a club trophy competition, a pot for big bass and bluegill, a contest for casting distance and accuracy, hourly casting clinics, and a drawing for prizes after the weigh-in. Check the website at www.bassonthefly.org. That's www.bassonthefly.org for this year's date and all the other information. Lake Fork is the home of the Texas state record 18.2-pound largemouth bass, and each year records hundreds of fish caught in the 5 to 10-pound range and several 13-pound-plus entries into the Lone Star Share a Lunker program. So visit their website at www.bassonthefly.org and check out this tournament. Before we introduce Skip, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And on our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win there in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Skip's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a copy of Skip's DVD, The Art of Tying the Bass Fly, courtesy of Amato Books. You can see more about what Amato has to offer in the way of books and DVDs at amatobooks.com. That's A-M-A-T-O books.com. So here's how you can win Skip's DVD. You've got to be the first person to answer the question at the end of the show. And the question is going to be something that Skip and I talk about during the show, so you've got to listen carefully. Submit your answer on the homepage in that same text box where you can ask questions. Be sure to put in your name and your location, and the first person that answers the question correctly will win Skip's DVD on tying bass flies. Tonight, our guest is Skip Morris. Skip has published 12 fly fishing books, including a bestseller currently in its 22nd printing, Fly Tying Made Clear and Simple. He has also authored many other books, including Fly Tying Made Clear and Simple 2, Advanced Techniques, The Art of Tying the Nymph, The Art of Tying the Dry Fly, The Art of Tying the Bass Fly, Tying Foam Flies, Concise Handbook of Fly Tying, The Custom Graphite Fly Rod, Morris and Chan on Fly Fishing Trout Lakes, Waterproof Fly Fisher's Guide, Western River Hatches, as well as Morris on Tying Flies and Trout Flies for Rivers. Skip has written and published over 200 articles on fly fishing and fly tying, along with a smaller number on jazz guitar, which have appeared in the following magazines: Fly Rod and Reel, Fly Tire, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, Warm Water Fly Fishing, Fly Tying, American Angler, Salmon, Trout, Steelheader, Western Outdoors, Fly Fisherman, Fly Fusion, Midwest Fly Fishing, Hatches, and Just Jazz Guitar. In the fall of 1996 issue of Fly Tying Magazine, an article was published about Skip, and it was entitled Skip Morris, The Man in the Painting. Skip's original fly patterns are tied and distributed by the Solitude Fly Company of Alhambra, California. Their current catalog contains about 30 of Skip's patterns, many in several sizes. The Fly Shop in California, one of the major fly fishing mail order houses, also carries several of Skip's patterns in its catalog and on its website. Skip is an instructor on 6 videos and has worked in radio and television as both a fly fishing host and celebrity guest. He lives amid the rivers and lakes and saltwater beaches of Washington State's wild and magnificent Olympic Peninsula. Well, Skip, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, Roger.
Well, it looks like you could just start your own library here with all that you've written.
Well, I'd be a little limited, but yeah, I've been busy, all right.
Yeah, you're very prolific on publishing of books, so you've got some great ones out there. I know I own several copies, so
thank you.
Appreciate all your contributions to that. Well, Skip, we've got a lot of questions came in tonight from our listeners out there about largemouth bass and tying bass bugs and so forth, so we've got lots to talk about. So you're ready to dive in?
I am.
Okay, and let's first talk about, we have a question from Jeff in Chilliwack, B.C., and he's got a very good question here. He says, and this could apply to many parts of the country, I suppose, but he says, we've got such an abundance of great fish in the Northwest, and you live right up there in the Northwest, right in the middle of all this.
Oh, yeah, not that far.
Yeah, steelhead, sea run, cutthroat, salmon, Dolly Varden, and a huge rainbows. Why should I spend a day targeting largemouth bass?
You know, around this part of the country, that's a pretty common question. And to be honest with you, I understand his point. We have a great diversity of fishing out here, and a lot of it is, you know, magnificent, and I love trout and salmon as well, but especially trout I just adore, and it's a big part of my life, but I love bass as well, and I guess the best answer I could give to Jeff is that it's bass fishing is just an entirely different experience. And so when you've caught enough steelhead and you've caught enough rainbows and trout and the rest, you know, if you want to try something really different that is a ton of fun, try bass. And I think that would be the best reason of all.
And why are bass fun? What makes them a fun
target? Oh, man. Largemouth bass are just a hoot because they fight like crazy. They just come flying out of water and tail walk around, and they smack a bug back in the lily pads, which no trout, you know, would ever do, at least not a bass bug, and rarely would they hit like a bass does. And it's just a whole different kind of fishing. I mean, largemouth bass can be back in the thickest stuff where you'd never catch a trout, and you'll haul a big bass out of there, and it's just a great counterpoint to all that other fishing he's talking about.
And you really have largemouth in probably almost every state in the lower 48 here in the U.S., don't you?
Oh, I would guess every state. Yeah. Hawaii as well.
Yeah, Hawaii, yeah. Alaska maybe not, but...
Yeah, it's a little far north.
Yeah.
Even
but, Jeff, yeah, I mean, almost any farmer's pond has some largemouth in it that you can go after, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Ponds, lakes... You know, reservoirs.
Yeah, yeah.
Lots of that around here.
And what makes them different than smallmouth? We all like to target smallmouth. They're a real kick, too. But what do you see the major differences between the two?
They just are different fish. You know, I remember way, way back when I first started fishing for bass, and this was back when I was a teenager, I caught largemouth first, and then at one point I finally caught some smallmouth, and I had trouble telling them apart. Now, they just seem very different. But they do look different, but they look more alike than they do different, I think. As far as the way they behave, oh, man, it's, you know, smallmouth in some ways are almost more like catching trout than catching largemouth. They will take smaller flies. I've seen smallmouth up sipping on little tiny mayfly hatches. And, I mean, decent smallmouth. And smallmouth seem to prefer moving water. If not moving water, at least they like rocky, clear water, where largemouth like, you know, lily pads and fallen logs, and they don't, mud's fine with them. So they're different fish. Largemouth, even the fight, largemouth will fight very hard, but it doesn't last too long. You know, their wind isn't so great, and smallmouth will just fight hard forever. And, you know, I could go on and list other things after that. I mean, just for an example, the way you work a floating fly is just dramatically different for largemouth and smallmouth, just for an example.
Okay. Well, go ahead. Yeah, go into detail on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, with largemouth, it's a big waiting game. You cast out that floating fly, you give it a tug, and then you wait a long time before you do anything else. And a lot of times that's when the bass will hit it. I mean, it's surprising how long they'll sit there and stare at that thing until they make up their mind. Whereas a smallmouth, if you let it sit like that, you won't catch very many. Normally you wouldn't want it just chugging along one tug after another, but you would only wait maybe 2, 3, 4 seconds between tugs of the bug. And if you wait much longer than that, they lose interest.
And don't you find the largemouth more in still water and smallmouth more in moving water as a generalization, would you?
Yeah, I'm not a big, I mean, a number of times I've caught smallmouth in lakes, a good number of times, but that's not really my forte. But, I mean, so I can't really say that smallmouth prefer moving water, but they do really well in it. And largemouth, they're really, you know, I hardly ever seem to find them in moving water. And if it is moving water, it's moving so slowly that it's a heck of a lot like not moving water.
Yeah, or backwaters off of a main river or something. I know in Wisconsin,
yes.
You know, you find a little bay or something and it's tucked in there rather than out in the main current kind of thing. Yeah.
Right, like a slough or a
yeah.
channel or something, you bet.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've got great memories of fishing for largemouth when I was a kid, too. It was just, you know, wading up in my up to my chest with no waders in a lake, you know, and fly fishing with topwater flies like mosquitoes and stuff they'd take. But, yeah, you know, on a warm summer day, that's the other thing is it gives you, kind of like people are going after carp nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it gives you another opportunity where some of these other fishes where they aren't available or, you know, the season isn't right, but, you know, the largemouth might be right there for you. So those are those other reasons, I think, that people might want to target them. We've got some questions about equipment here. We've got Chuck Campbell in Buffalo, New York, and he's asked, says, I'm new to bass fishing with a fly rod. I'm actually a trout salmon fly fisherman, but I remember fishing for largemouths with topwater lures and loved it. Can you suggest an outfit that would get me started? So what would you recommend for someone starting out after largemouth? What do they need for rod, weight, length?
Well, you know, there are all kinds of different theories about length, and there are some people who like really short rods for largemouth, you know, down to 7 feet. I don't think that's necessary. I usually fish an 8.5-foot rod, and plenty of people fish a 9, so I think just a normal length, which, you know, nowadays seems to be 9 feet. I think the big thing is the line and the line weight. And, you know, there are special bass tapers, and if you do a lot of fishing with big bass bugs, they make a lot of sense. But, I mean, if Chuck has, maybe I should speak to Chuck. Chuck, if you have a 6-weight outfit for trout and it's not a super soft rod, you know, you can make that work with smaller bass bugs and still catch bigger bass. Ideally, you know, so I'm saying go out and try it with that. If you have a 6-weight, a 7-weight would do it for sure. But for most largemouth bass fishing that I do, a 7-weight is probably ideal. And for places where they catch really big bass, you know, sometimes they'll go with an 8, and I've heard of even heavier. But I don't know. It's hard to beat a 7.
Okay, okay. I think you kind of answered the next question. Rob in Middleton, Connecticut, says he's trying to decide what rod and reel would be best since I already have a 5-weight for trout and a 9-weight for stripers and blues. I'm leaning towards a 7-weight, 9-foot, but many use an 8-weight. And use it for steelhead as well. Can't afford to fill all the holes. It's a common problem out there.
Yeah. Well,
we need one of each.
Yeah.
But you just said, yeah, 7-8 right in there. Either one would be good, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, let's see, where is he? He's in Connecticut.
Yeah.
I would guess that a 7 would probably be just right. But,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If he's considering the steelhead thing and he thinks he needs a heavier rod for that, then why not, you know? I mean, you know, I spent 10 years designing fly rods and building fly rods, and the opinion after all that is that I think we give a little too much credence to line weight. I never felt that I ever, on the toughest spring creek I've ever fished, and I've fished some tough ones, had to go under a 4-weight, yet you can go out there and buy odd lines now, you know, and probably even lighter, I don't know. But a lot of it, you know, sometimes people are trying to fix, and I'm not getting, you know, on, let's see, who are we talking to? Rob. I'm not getting on him at all. It's a legitimate question. But, you know, the fear that a line's too heavy and it's going to scare the fish, usually it's the cast or the length of the leader or both that are going to scare the fish, I think personally, and not so much the weight of the line.
Mm-hmm.
So if he goes a little heavy, I don't see a problem.
And the other two things is, you know, having a beefy enough rod to fight the fish, you know, get them in quickly, right? And also to throw the big bugs, right?
Yeah, yeah, those are two big factors because you're right, especially for big bass. Man, some of those some of those flies are big and wind-resistant, and it takes some doing to get them out there. And then the other thing is, as you say, on the whole, the heavier the line weight, the stiffer the rod because it has to handle that additional weight. And with largemouth bass, a lot of times it's a wrestling match. It's not like trout where they're running and screaming off, you know, line off the reel and all that stuff. It's hand-to-hand.
Mm-hmm. We've got, I'm going to go down to Jason's question here, Ventura, California. He says, I use a 6-weight, 9-foot rod for fishing largemouth in local lakes. I'm trying to get a bit more distance casting big bugs. Will the weight or design of furled twined leader help to turn over wind-resistant bugs better than the bass tapered knotless leader I've been using?
That's a very good question to which I have really no answer at all. I know a little bit about furled leaders. I know how they're made, but honestly, whether they would be better than the, you know, the tapered leaders that are designed for bass, I just couldn't tell you. But I think we're lucky that we have leaders designed specifically for bass now. You know, they're getting a little respect, and it is a very different kind of fishing from other kinds, and trout especially. Boy, I don't know. Beyond that, I don't think I have anything of value.
Okay, yeah, you just personally haven't tested the two. And
no.
But you would say go with the bass tapered leaders that are being made for that as opposed to others, right?
Especially for the bigger bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, where I live, for example, I can sometimes catch a lot of largemouth bass, but a big one is 12 or 13 inches, and a huge one is, you know, a fish that's 2 pounds or 2.5 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So my bass bugs are smaller than most here. Now, I have fished all over the United States for bass, you know, not greatly, but I have done it in the East, and I've fished in the Midwest and the South and everything else. And a lot of times I was fishing bigger bugs, because out here we just don't tend to get large bass.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where it really comes into play, when you use a heavier line and the right leader and all that stuff.
Another question about line and leader. Dan Crowthers in Bismarck, North Dakota asks, what type of line, floating or sinking? If sinking, what type and why? So what do you use for lines?
Let's see. Well, for floating, as I said, a 6 can work if you're not throwing real big stuff. And, you know, you can go bass taper, or, you know, you can do fine with a double taper or a weight forward, a standard one, unless they're really big bugs, and then you start appreciating that bass taper. Sinking lines, well, that brings up the whole issue of trying to find bass down there with their hidden structure, you know. And the main thing about sinking lines is just that they sink fast enough to get the fly down there. So I would say, you know, I usually use a type 3 or a type 4 sinking line, which designates the sink rate. And it's a full sinking line, not a sink tip.
Mm. Now, do you find yourself using one or the other more so than not, a floating versus a sinking?
Oh, yeah. I'm too much of a weenie to... I only chase bass in the depths when the bass make me do it. I mean, I shouldn't say that. That's not always the case, but usually that's the case. So I do the vast majority of my fishing with a floating line.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the excitement is too, right? I mean,
yeah, well, that's the great debate, you know. I mean, it is neat to have that sinking line go down there into the depths and not know what it's doing and just imagine it. And then when you get a pull, you know, that's a whole different kind of excitement. But it's not the visual excitement of a floating bug, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like dry fly fishing for trout versus nymphing, you know.
I think it's exactly like it, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people prefer the dry fly because they can see what's going on and enjoy that activity. Yeah, yeah.
And I think they're afraid of the nymph, and I think they're afraid of the sinking line in bass fishing, and I don't think they should be, but...
And both are more work, I think, too, you know. I mean, you have to work harder with the sinking lines and the nymphing than you do the other, I think, so...
I think that's true.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about food and bugs, and I know you're big on the tying, so hopefully you can help educate us along those lines. So let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Skip Morris about largemouth bass and bugs. If you'd like to ask Skip a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many as possible on the show tonight. Well, let me just check there. You know, we've got a few questions in here, Skip. Let me just see if we got any follow-ups on what we've been talking about. Oh, Mike, Hampton, Virginia asks, do you overline your rods to help cast larger bass bugs?
Well, that's a good question, and I got a good answer since I designed rods for a lot of years and built them. That will slow down the rod and open up the loop. But the problem with that is that bass bugs take some force. So when you overline a rod, you take some of the guts out of it. So my tendency is simply to adjust my casting and use a rod that's got pretty good power for bass bugs. I wouldn't want a real stiff rod, when I say that, I mean a fast action rod, which is a confusing term, but in other words, I wouldn't want a rod that felt stiff right up until almost like the last third of the rod. I would want a rod that the flex was spread a little more evenly. I wouldn't necessarily want one real slow where the butt was working a lot, but I'd want with some good butt power, but not too stiff throughout most of the rod. And with good power overall, and then you adjust your casting. You know, when you cast a bug, you have to wait a little longer for that heavy or wind-resistant fly to get out there, and you might even let the leader straighten out a little more than usual and stretch out your stroke and open up your casting loop a little bit. But bottom line is, I wouldn't overline a rod. I would rely more on changing my casting to fit the situation.
We had another follow-up question here from Kenny in Noblesville, Indiana. It says, do you recommend floating or sinking line for a small river that is about 10 feet deep? So I'm assuming this is a slow-moving, when we're talking about largemouth, a slow-moving river, even though it's small.
Yeah. My normal assumption would be that he's talking about smallmouth bass, but it's possible. It's certainly possible he's talking about largemouth. And he was asking what?
Do you recommend floating or sinking line, and being that the river is about 10 feet deep? So I'm guessing that he's trying to judge where those fish are in a 10-foot column, you know.
Right. Boy, I'd kind of like to have both.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if they are 10 feet down with water moving at all, it's going to be tough to get most flies down there to them. But then they can also be up around the shallows and around the cover and such, you know, and probably will spend a lot of time there, and then I'd use the floating line.
Okay. A lot of that is just finding where the fish are at to determine, you know, what you're going to use, right?
Right. Exactly.
And we can talk about that a little bit more later when we're talking about strategies and tactics in here. Well, before we jump into food and bugs, tell us a little bit about what's been happening in your fly fishing world and what you've been up to recently.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you asking. My wife and I are chugging away whenever we're not out working on something else. I do a lot of speaking, so we're traveling a lot, but we've been working real hard on this website we've got, and you can pick that up by just putting in Skip Morris Fly Tying. And we've got all kinds of information on there, some of my articles that have been previously published, and we're adding new stuff all the time. So that's been a big project, and I've got two new books in the last year or year and a half. One is the, Fly Patterns. What was that called, Carol? Trout Flies for Rivers. I'm sorry. And we went through some possible names at one point. Some of them stuck in my mind, but it's called Trout Flies for Rivers. And the other one is Fly Tying Made Clear and Simple 2, which is the follow-up to my first book, and this one starts where the first one ends. So those are my two new books, and I'm working on, as a matter of fact, it's funny that we're talking about bass because I've been putting every day, all day, into a reworking of a book called The Art of Tying the Bass Fly, and that's going to get a big, major updating, and that's what I'm working at real hard right now, so bass are on my mind.
Yeah, Kim had a motto. I had asked her that this morning, and she said, yeah, we're going to be republishing that, in the spring, the target time for that book. So we'll look forward to that update. Yeah, that'd be great. Well, good. Sounds like you've been keeping busy. Doing a lot of writing and so forth, so that's great.
Yeah, well, what's in town?
Let's see what else we got here. Talking about food and bugs here, what do you think largemouth bass primarily feed on? Because that's always, you know, we're always trying to, you know, reproduce whatever the naturals are in whatever we tie. So we always want to start there. What do they eat?
You know, I know what they eat. I don't know what primarily they eat, and it probably varies in different parts of the country, I would almost bet. Because I remember fishing for largemouth in California, and they were all feeding on, it was some kind of bait fish. I can't remember, but man, they just wanted something that looked like that bait fish, or that was it. And I've seen largemouth bass just completely focused on dragonfly adults when they start buzzing around and mating and dropping on the water in the afternoon to where all the fish were right where the, you know, dragonfly adults were, and they were waiting, and they'd come flying out of water sometimes and grab one in midair. It's really neat, and I've seen that a number of times. So it kind of depends on where you are and when. And beyond that, all I can say is that they tend to feed on bigger things that they can catch. And, you know, so little insects, I'm sure they feed on some of those because I've caught bass on little wet flies and things when I was fishing for bluegill. I've caught some hooks and big bass. But I think on the whole, they're after the big stuff, bigger stuff. So, you know, big insects like dragonfly nymphs, adult dragonflies, leeches. They probably once in a while get their mouths around a frog and, you know, snakes, water snakes, anything, and certainly other fishes like, you know, bluegills, especially small ones, and bass fry, you know, they're young. I haven't seen studies, but, you know, I know for a fact they feed on all those things.
Yeah, so they sound more opportunistic feeders, right? It's moving and big enough, I'm going to eat it kind of thing, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's kind of goes back to that first question about why should I bother with bass, and that's one of the big differences between bass and trout, and that's what fools trout fishermen is when they realize that bass are not normally selective, which trout fairly frequently are. Then they think, well, they must be dumb, but the fact is they'd starve to death if they were selective. There usually aren't, you know, there usually isn't a sudden abundance of the things that they feed on.
Mm-hmm.
So selectivity just doesn't fit the picture, but they will become selective without a doubt. I've seen it a number of times, and most of the time the thing is when they've had some experience, when somebody's caught them and put them back or, you know, whatever, they really will get picky about the things that you throw at them. They'll look them over, and if something doesn't seem right, that's it. They just turn away and swim off.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you think that the largemouth are more hunters, or are they more ambush type, you know, thinking along the lines of pike that are more ambushing kind of fish?
Well, they're certainly not grazers, you know, as trout so often are.
Mm-hmm.
I always kind of like to compare bass and trout because I've gone all over the country, you know, to talk people into giving bass a try. I've even gone into the deep south where most fly fishermen seem to feel that they have to drive to a trout stream, you know, some tailwater 200 miles away, and in the meantime, they're driving over all this great bass water, you know, that might even be in their backyard. So I tend to compare things with trout, but anyway, trout, you know, they'll come up and feed on a hatch and pick off little mayflies, and that's kind of a grazer, but a you know, largemouth there, I guess, to me, a hunter and an ambush are kind of one and the same, but yeah, bass sneak up on things, and they hit them hard and fast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're kind of like cats.
Mm-hmm.
They're really good hunters.
Feline cats, not catfish, huh? Yeah.
No, not catfish.
Yeah, yeah. Pouncer, you're like the pike, too, you know. Stay, wait, and attack, right?
Right.
Yeah.
They're pretty sneaky about it, too.
Yeah. Let's see, we got Kevin in Plainfield, Illinois, and he says, I love fishing with bass poppers. I've had better success using hard-bodied cork poppers than foam. My favorite commercial popper is the frugal frog. The largest bass I ever caught was using a very small frugal frog popper. What is your opinion about hard-bodied poppers?
My opinion is that they work just fine. People catch a ton of bass on them, and there's nothing in the world wrong with them. The foam poppers have a little advantage, I think, and that's that when a largemouth clamps down on it, it feels sort of alive, and they're liable to hold onto it longer. Now, that's where the spun hair flies come in, which, you know, as a fly tire, I love those more than these other two. But, man, they'll just sit there and chew on a spun hair fly because they're pretty soft. And, I mean, I've had bass do that just, you know, where I didn't bother to set the hook, just see how long they'd sit there and gnaw on the thing, and they were convinced it was alive. So with cork, they'll touch it, and they'll go, nope, and they'll spit it out right away. But with the hair, they'll really go after it. And right in the middle would be the foam.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the advantage. But they all work, for sure.
So that your hierarchy is, your preference would be the hair, deer hair, the foam, and then the hard body, just because of that mouthing, right?
Yeah, and because I'm a fly tire. You can
not much fun to just tie a tail on the hard body, huh?
No, yeah. And I don't even know where you can get the hard bodies without the tail, so
yeah.
You can't even do that. But, yeah, tying bass flies is amazing. I mean, you know, when you get into all that spun hair stuff and you start stacking colors and flipping over colors and putting another on top of it so they have a white belly and a green back with stripes across it, all done with different colors of hair. And I mean, it's just an amazing facet of fly tying.
Yeah, it becomes very artistic, sounds like, for you.
It can, real fast.
It's creations, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it sure can.
We've got Frank Wood in Norwalk, California, and he says, are you familiar with the Lake Tapley's bass bug? And if so, what's your opinion of it?
Sure, yeah, I know Tap's bug. You bet. In fact, I gave instructions on how to tie it in a book called Morris on Tying Flies. So I did some research on it and did some research on Tap Tapley, who's another story. I remember him from when I was a kid. But, yeah, that's a great old bug. It works just, you know, it's real simple. And, you know, it's almost kind of like the essential bass bug. It just has some different colors, but they're placed in a real easy way. And it works. You know, those really basic bugs work. It doesn't have eyes. It doesn't have rubber legs. You know, its tail is as elemental as it can be, just some bucktail. But it's a good fly.
Maybe one to start out with if you've not tied some bass bugs up.
Yeah, I would say so, with one exception, that it's a little different in that you actually get a certain, which isn't hard to find, but you try to find bucktail that's actually almost like deer hair on its butt end. So the tail, let's see, the butts of the tail become the first hair that's flared on the shank instead of what you would normally do, which is tie in the tail and then start flaring hair separately.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little different, and that's the only tricky part, but it's not very tricky.
Yeah, yeah. Skip, we got a couple questions that came out on the internet, both about weed guards. Kevin in Noblesville, Indiana, says, what's your feeling on weed guards for bass bugs? And then Mike in Oshawa, Ontario, says, what style of weed guard do you find works best defending against snagging? Doesn't hinder hookup.
Okay.
So they're both asking kind of the same thing here.
We got the snag guard group showing up here.
Yeah, yeah. They're in the weeds where the bass are.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, there are so many ways, and there I go again, but there are so many ways that trout fishermen really have a tough time with bass, and one of them is getting used to the fact that they're going to have to, a lot of times, throw their flies back in a foot of water way back in the lily pad fields or, you know, whatever kind of junk is in there, which I think is part of what's so great about bass. It's really a hoot doing that. But when you do that, and you do that a lot with largemouth, yeah, snag guard is just often, you couldn't do it without it. You know, you couldn't get by without it. So, yeah, I'm an absolute believer in snag guards. And I just tie the kind that's the old simple loop of monofilament tied down the bend of the hook partway, and that it goes outside the point and up and is tied at the eye of the hook again, bound on. And what you do is you cast out the fly and you work it just as you normally would. And if you get to something that you have to crawl it over, like a lily pad or a log or something, you just work it very slowly, and the weed guard works just great. You know, it keeps the point of the hook from touching the object. When a bass hits, it's just the opposite. You drop the rod tip a little, pull in a little line, and just wham. And that's why I'm saying you don't want a soft rod, you know. But you really just kind of, I like to say, kind of, you try to cross their eyes, you hit them so hard. And that snaps the point of the hook past the weed guard and just sinks it right in. And it always sounded, when I was first getting into bass fishing as a kid, I thought, well, this isn't going to work. And then I found out it works just great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, weed guards, you bet. I'm all for them.
Okay. And it sounds like, you know, the largemouth is a pretty strong bite. I mean, they're going to clamp down on that thing and not worry too much about the feel of a weed guard as maybe a trout would, you know, mouth that around a little bit.
You know, the thing about the weed guard is that it's really not projecting all that much further than the point of the hook. So, I mean, I think, you know, I'd probably rather they felt a weed guard than a hook, to be honest with you. So, you know, maybe.
So by the time they get to start feeling that, they're about a split second away from getting hooked anyway.
Oh, yeah. And it probably feels a lot more natural than feeling the point of a hook.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. No doubt. But we got a couple of questions on worms here. We have Udo in Eagan, Minnesota. He says, I know the hardware guys fish plastic worms pretty slow at times. Do you find certain flies can be fished in the same manner? And the question came in, maybe you can kind of mix up your answer here. One came in on the internet. Geraldo in Boise, Idaho asks, a plastic worm over the years has proven deadly in the largemouth. What are some of the fly patterns that mimic the action of the plastic worm? So maybe you can kind of combine these to talk about, is there something to mimic the good old standby worm, or then how would you fish it?
There are things in the ballpark, for sure. And that's, you know, that's been something that fly tires have been always looking at, is the success of what they call the plastic worms in gear fishing for largemouth bass. And they fish those so slowly that a lot of times, I mean, it's really, they're almost functioning as bait. And I'm not saying that as a negative thing, but I'm just saying as a reality, I think they're, you know, they smell, a lot of them, I think. They used to anyway, and they have a rubbery body, and so I think they're practically edible. But, yeah, we have things like the, let's see, Andy Burke has one that's got a long, it looks like a plastic worm practically, but it's not. And I think any of the subsurface bass flies that have like a lot of marabou, or they have a long, you know, rabbit strip for a tail with the fur on it, those things just wave like mad. And
the leechy kind of things looking.
Yeah. Or the good old Dave's eelworm streamer, you know, Dave Whitlock's fly. If they've got some weight on them, you can cast them out, let them sink, and then just keep making them come up again. And every time you give it a little pull up, that thing just creeps along and snakes along the way it swims and just undulates real enticingly. So, you know, I've even got one that's in the Art of the Bass Fly, and it's going to stay in this new edition because it's been so good for me. But it's designed to float, but it does have wavy legs and a waving tail, rabbit strip tail, and you fish it with a full sinking line, and then the line gets down and finds the bottom, and every time you tug, this thing goes down and then comes back up and, you know, just kind of creeps along like that. So all those flies, I think, really are related to that plastic worm fishing.
And, you know, you kind of talked a little bit about the retrieve there. On any of these kinds of flies that you've just talked about, where we're trying to simulate a worm or leech, is retrieve very slow too, just like you were talking about on the surface?
You know, you just kind of have to go with what the bass want. And with flies that really perform their best on a slow retrieve, you know, it makes sense to retrieve them very slowly. And like I said, these billowy flies for sure. On the surface, it's just, that's what works. You know, that long wait after the fly first gives its first chug or two on the surface, just that motionless wait. But there are certainly times when a fast retrieve, you know, some kind of streamer or even a surface fly, you know, like a hair bug, really made to, you know, kind of scoot along steadily is the answer.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you can talk about it more here. Mark in Texas asks, what are the best flies to use when the bite is active on the following lures? Number one, spinner baits. Number two, crank baits. And number three, plastic worms.
Well, spinner baits are tough because they're just flashy as can be, and they move along quickly. You don't have a choice with a spinner bait. There are, I believe, bass flies that have a little spinner on them, and that's probably the closest thing. Let's see.
But something very flashy and fast retrieve is really
right.
Trying to simulate there.
Right, and we do have a handful of bass flies that actually have some kind of lip on them so that they swim. Bob Pop, they're created in all kinds of funny ways, but Bob Popovich was making some out of wool and then stiffening them with, I think it was silicone caulk or something like that, and they would have lips on them, and they would dart back and forth like a crankbait. On the whole, though, you know, we just simply use bass flies, sinking bass flies, that every time we tug them, they kind of dive or they jerk a little to one side or the other, and we kind of get the same effect as a crankbait without having a swimming lip on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the plastic... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Pete Parker, I don't know if you know Pete Parker, but he...
Oh, yeah.
He tied a fly that had a propeller on the front. Little propellers. Maybe that's in there somewhere.
Pete's crazy. Yeah, he ties some amazing stuff. And, yeah, I've known Pete for years. I've worked with him in some of the big sports shows. But, yeah, he ties some really amazing bass flies. And I'm sure some of them are completely impractical. But that one, I don't know. That, because some of them
you don't know that one. Well, maybe that's his secret, see? That's one of his secret flies. You know? Only there's only three of us that know about it. See?
Well, he's got stuff like bat imitations that look real, you know. And it's just, I think he's into the surreal stuff. But, but Pete, I'd love to talk to him again. It's been a while.
Yeah. So, lastly, you kind of addressed the plastic worm thing. But
yeah, I don't think I can add anything to that.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, we need to take a quick break here again. And when we return, we'll talk more about bass bugs and what we can use for them. So, hang tight. We'll be right back. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. Anything will help out the cause. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Are you listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio? We're talking with Skip Morris about largemouth bass and bugs. If you'd like to ask Skip a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's see what we got here, Skip. Checking out here on the Internet. Okay, we've got Bob here in Rhode Island, and he says, "Hi, Skip. Why is it every time the subject of largemouth bass fly fishing comes up, all anybody wants to talk about are deer hair bugs or popping bugs? Why can't we talk about subsurface flies?" Well, we just did, Bob. But do you want to add anything to that about the effectiveness of subsurface?
Well, yeah. I mean, if the bass aren't willing to come up to the top, you know, you can either quit fishing or you can go subsurface. And I got nothing in the world against subsurface.
Yeah.
You know, if the fish, sometimes they just won't come up to the top, but they'll come, you know, they're only in 3 feet of water or 4 feet of water, and then I'll just use a floating line and a weighted streamer or something, and I'll let it sink down and work it slowly, and boom, I'm getting bass again. Other times they're out there in the structure, and then that's a whole other world, but that can be dealt with too. Yeah, I still think, honestly, that a lot of it comes back to fear. I mean, I'm with the clinics and workshops that I do, I often find that, you know, especially, like, for example, with nymph fishing, people are just afraid of it, you know. I can't see my fly, you know, what am I going to do? I don't know, you know, they just fret, and they're afraid of it. And I think people who fly fish or bass are a little bit uncomfortable about, fear might not be the right word, but just discomfort with trying something new and trying something that isn't, you know, is in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it has its place, absolutely.
Yeah. Mike in Cincinnati, Ohio, says, "Our spin-casting brethren believe soft plastics catch more bass due to the bass keeping it in their mouth longer, thus allowing more time to set the hook. Do you believe that is the case? And if so, is there a place for soft plastics in the fly fisher person's vest?" And I think you kind of talked about this earlier, about the hard poppers, about the feel in the mouth, right?
Right, and I think that goes for the surface flies and the subsurface as well. That's part of my argument for more spun hair flies.
Right, yeah.
Which I like anyway because I love tying them. But, you know, as far as bringing plastic worms to put on a fly rod, I mean, I'm pretty open-minded. That I haven't tried that. I think there may come a time when we are actually not uncommon to attach those things to a fly, maybe even temporarily. We already have some flies that have curly tails that are cut out of leather or other materials that will flap
right
behind the fly, so it's not that big a leap to have a little part of the fly where you can stick on some plastic, but as far as I know, it isn't really happening yet, partly because if you tied a fly and tied in the plastic, that would be the first thing to go, and the rest of the fly would be, then, you know, wouldn't really make sense, probably,
depending
on the design.
Right, and the weight issue, too, I suppose.
Yeah, they're pretty dense. Plastics are pretty dense, and if they had any much volume to them at all, that would get interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that kind of brings up a good question or topic for discussion. I don't know that there is an answer, but, you know, where does the fly fishing world move into the lure world, and, you know, what's the dividing line for the purist, you know? Because we use so many synthetic products nowadays. You know,
it used
to be you could say, well, if it isn't tied with feathers, you know, and yarn, then it's not a fly. But there's so much crossover now. Where does it start and where does it end?
Oh, yeah, and that debate just is always going, and it's always changing because, you know, as soon as we started using nylon thread, we couldn't really make that argument that, you know, it has to be all natural. You know, when they went away from silk, and good Lord, that was like half a century ago, so at least. You know, I've always been fine with using synthetics in fly tying. I've always been open to that, and combining them with natural materials as well. And one thing I've really noticed in my lifetime, and I'm turning 60 in a few months, so I've been fishing a while. I probably started fly fishing at about 11 or 12. It's the line and the debates are always changing. You know, we kind of think this is the way it is and this is, we've picked our side of this issue. And then it's just always changing. I mean, we're fishing with strike indicators now and people think those are bobbers, and in some ways they're probably right, but it's well-established practice now, and we're doing all kinds of things that people weren't doing even in the 1970s, and the purists would have torn their hair out back then, and now their children, or even they themselves, are probably doing a lot of those things. It's just fly fishing's always changing, and I don't, you know, there's a lot to learn from the other side, you know. I'm not against spin fishing and bait casting and all that stuff, because when I was a kid, I was pretty quick to pick up a spinning rod if the fly rod wasn't working, and so I understand both, and I just, you know, as long as it's not hurting the fish, I don't have too much trouble with it, but I would hope in my ideal world that everybody would become fly fishermen regardless.
Yeah. We've got a couple of questions here off the internet from Travis in Fargo, North Dakota. He says he's had good luck with chartreuse and white for both smallmouth and largemouth bass. Are there any differences in the two species as related to color preference? What color combinations are good for largemouth?
That's a good question. You know, I've never been a big fisherman of chartreuse, not because I had anything against it, but I fished every other color. And I really tried chartreuse this summer for smallmouth particularly, because I kept hearing that it was so great for smallmouth. And the smallmouth I fished for, I tried it over and over over a period of probably a couple of weeks of fishing and never really did that well with chartreuse. They kept turning their nose up at it. But I'm sure that people who swear by it where they live, it works great. And that really actually makes a good point, is that all fishing is to a degree local, you know. You can go from one lake to the next lake a mile down the road, and the fish will act completely differently. It's the weirdest thing, but I've seen it over and over again, probably more often than not. And so it's hard to say, but I mean, yeah, so I'm not a big nut about chartreuse. I probably should try it for largemouth bass more. I've barely touched it. I've barely tried it for largemouth. But for largemouth, I usually use a lot of green, and I use purple sometimes and black. And I've had really good luck at times with just pure white, which is fun to fish. Like if you're fishing a sinking fly in pure white and your water's clear, it's really fun to see the fly moving through the water and then see it just disappear because the fly is now in the mouth of a dark bass and it just disappears, you know.
Yeah.
I've used tan successfully, and I'd say those are the main colors. Brown, yeah. Quite a bit.
Well, I know the old chartreuse in white was really kind of put on the map with Bob Clouser and his Clouser minnow, you know. And that was, a smallmouth pattern, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think originally that was a smallmouth pattern.
Now that people use it for everything, but, you know.
Right.
But I think he designed it for smallmouth on the east, you know, which, like you say, worked well for him there, yeah.
Oh, yeah, many smallmouth fishermen feel that chartreuse is the best color ever invented, and I believe that there's experience to back that up. I just, haven't had that experience.
Yeah, yeah. Travis has a second question. He says, are there any classic fly patterns that work well for largemouth?
Oh, yeah.
If you look through a few of those?
Yeah. I mean, the obvious one is the hair bug. And, you know, very few hair bugs have specific names, like, for example, Taps bug, the one we talked about earlier. And that's, which is really funny, in a world where, you know, every traditional dry fly that is some little different color, you know, a slightly different shade of body and everything else the same, gets a whole new name, but you can have a million different bass bugs, and this is a hair bass bug or a bass bug with rubber legs, and this is a hair bass bug with a hackle tail, and this is a hair bass bug with rubber legs for a tail and with eyes, but they're just bass bugs. You know, most of that stuff doesn't get its own name. So the hair bass bug, however you get it, is absolutely a classic for surface fishing. And the Dahlberg diver has definitely become a classic in the last, 25 years, and is an excellent fly, and other diver flies are often excellent as well. And those dive just a little bit under the water, but that can make the difference. Boy, as far as subsurface flies that are classic, I guess the main one that comes to my mind is Dave's Eelworm Streamer, which I mentioned earlier, because it's definitely a good subsurface, real good subsurface bass fly. There are a lot of other really good subsurface bass flies, but I don't know if I could call them classics.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't think, he was just looking for any classics, I think, that whether subsurface or on the surface.
Yeah, that mostly covers it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't have and I know you're updating it, but are there new bugs you're adding to your updated book right now that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'm actually I'm changing a little fly I call the SMP because it's sort of evolved over the years, and that's a fly for panfish, although I have caught some really nice largemouths and smallmouths on it, a lot of them. But it's really a panfish fly primarily. And then I'm changing the chapter out for the crayfish fly that's in there because I've developed one that I think is really much, much better for the vast majority of places to fish, one that I fished a lot this summer and worked on. And, you know, but it's funny. I went through that book really thoroughly, and I looked at all the patterns, and I looked at what's out there again and really thought about it. And I guess, you know, sometimes you do something pretty well the first time, and it sticks because most of those patterns are still real viable, popular patterns, and I'm not changing that many. I'm thinking about changing some of the ones in the back of the book where there's sort of a collection of patterns, a bunch of them together. But as far as the ones that are tied in the book, I'm surprised at how few I'm changing.
Okay. Wayne in Montana asks, he says, what's your favorite large top water non-deer hair frog/popper pattern? Not out of deer hair.
Oh, boy.
Or don't you have one? No answer is fine, too. So.
You know what? I don't think I have a favorite.
Yeah, yeah. You really like the deer hair. I know.
I do like deer hair. Well, there are some good and inventive foam flies, and I've fished some of them, but I couldn't tell you what the names were. And I've even experimented with some of my own designs, but I can't say I know those specific patterns. And if that makes a guy who writes a lot of fly tying books, because I've written 7 fly tying books, look like he doesn't have a very good memory, well, that's half right, because I don't. But the other half is that there are hundreds of thousands of fly patterns out there, and I know just a few hundred really well. And that's as far as my poor little brain can go.
Yeah, yeah. We had another question from Dan in East Peoria, Illinois. He says, what are some good bass bug patterns for the beginning tire that are effective but not too difficult to tie? And, you know, in talking about your hair, I'm sure your hair bugs, there's one that you would suggest to start out with. And
oh, yeah, just a basic bass bug, just like the Taps bug. Put a bucktail on there and then spin deer hair or flare deer hair up the shank and trim it, and it's done. And if you want to glue on a couple eyeballs, go ahead. And that's as simple as it's going to get with flaring hair. And it works. It works for largemouth and smallmouth. And for subsurface, oh, you've got things like some of these. I'd have to look one up. But there are some leeches, like the bunny leech, for example, just has a rabbit strip with fur tail, and then you wrap some rabbit strip up the body. Real simple. Put some weight on the head, like a cone head or barbell eyes, you know. And I still like the Dave's Eelworm Streamer. That's a good one. And
okay,
those would probably be the simplest good ones.
Okay.
And, of course, a lot of people go right to the woolly bugger. And I don't think that's the best bass fly, especially for largemouth. But it does work. And so, you know.
But not your first choice to tie on, yeah.
Yeah, that's always a little less painful adjustment for a trout fisherman, too. Because they have a tough time tying on a big frog, you know. But they'll tie on a woolly bugger because they fished it before. And then that'll get them started.
We got a question from Rick Takahashi in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Rick was on our show talking about midge fishing, talking about one extreme to the other. You know, he opens his boxes of midges and he's got, you know, like 1,000 midges in a little box. So now we're jumping to big, you know, bass, deer hair things, and he wants to know, where is the best place to buy quality deer hair for spinning, and how do you go about selecting deer hair? Great question. And let's answer that one first. He's got a couple others here. But
okay, that is a good question, and I've figured out a formula for that. Do a lot of clinics and fly shops all over the country, and whenever you're in one, check the hair out, and then bring some back each time you find good stuff, and over a period of years, you'll have all the great deer hair you ever need.
So you mean personal inspection rather than
that may not
ordering
be great
it through the mail. Yeah.
Yeah, for most people, taking up a career in fly fishing so they can travel around and do clinics is probably not realistic, but that's what's worked for me. And consequently, I can't say that I have a real good source specifically. I know that Chris Helm used to sell deer hair, and I'm sure he's got, if he's still doing that, then that would be a good source. But, you know, I think the way to find the real good deer hair is to learn how to identify it.
That's what Rick was asking, too, is how do you go about selecting the deer hair? So can you kind of go through that with us?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I like. First of all, my favorite deer hair, and I've tried everything I get my hands on, and there's a lot of stuff that's really nice. I mean, there's some really nice elk, and there's some really nice antelope, but I have gone to what they call deer belly hair. And what I like about it is that it's kind of thick-shafted. It's sort of a dry hair that really compresses, but it's not exactly soft. Soft hair gets a little weird and doesn't, I don't think it floats as well. This is kind of stiff, almost has a brittle quality, but it's not brittle. And it's called deer belly hair. I think that's right. And they dye it in various colors, and then if you get white, that's the natural color of it. But that's my favorite. And what I want is hair that has decent length. And I don't know, I'd have to measure it to tell you what that is. It's probably at least an inch, maybe an inch and a half. And when I squeeze the hair, I want to feel that it's kind of stiff, and it compresses under the pressure. Boy, it's hard to describe. It's something where you tie a lot, and you find out what you like, and you just develop a feel for it, and it's really hard to quantify. But I think the simplest answer is to buy the deer belly hair, frankly, and not mess with elk. Elk is good, and, you know, honestly, I think elk floats better than deer, which really is a plus, and it's tougher, which really doesn't matter in this kind of tying. But the problem with elk is that it's just harder to work with. So keep the elk in mind in the future, but it's different. It's harder to compress.
Okay. Another question Rick had was, when designing a deer hair fly for bass, what do you consider the most important design aspects?
Well, you know, in any fly, I think it's kind of universal for me off the top of my head. I think durability is important, but probably more than durability is that the fly functions as it should. So in the case of bass flies, if it's supposed to dive, it had better dive and not do it, make you fight it to do that. If it's supposed to float and make a little gurgle, it should do that. So, you know, in other words, you look at the end result, does it do what it's supposed to do? So that's design. And then the second thing is, does it imitate something? And if it does it imitate it effectively from the fish's perspective, not necessarily from yours? So if it's supposed to convince the fish it's a frog, does it do that? You know, and you find that out by just showing it to a million fish. But, and then you've got, you know, if it doesn't imitate something, does it somehow attract fish regardless? And in bass fishing, more than trout fishing, I would say, we're often not bothering to imitate anything. We're just trying to show the bass something and convince it that it's edible, which gets us back to that whole thing about how you're not dealing with hatches a lot of the time and selectivity. So we use a lot of what I guess you would normally call attractors, although I don't think of them that way in bass flies. But, you know, like your basic bass bug really doesn't look like anything in particular.
It's nothing real. It's just the action and making it look alive is the key, right?
Exactly, yeah.
How you work it, and part of it is the materials you use. Right,
right, and the design.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. But those things, plus the classic ones like durability, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's important. You get a fly that falls apart, I don't think it's a very good fly, even if it catches fish.
Right, right, right. Well, Rick's got another question, but we'll come to that after we take another break here. And so we'll be right back and talk more about largemouth bass and bass bugs. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services that they offer both for Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit them at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Skip Morris about largemouth bass and bugs. If you'd like to ask Skip a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Rick's third question was, what hooks do you recommend for tying various types of bass flies?
Well, I would say normally the classic, you know, great big gape, fairly heavy wire hook with a big eye, big straight eye, and it's usually just called a bass hook or a bass fly hook.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I use that for subsurface, for surface. You know, sometimes you'll use a heavy wire streamer hook or something for a subsurface fly, but most of the time, it's pretty hard to beat that classic. Sometimes it's called a stinger hook, but they're not as extreme as the first stinger hooks were. And the angles and everything, they're a little quieter now, which I kind of like myself, and a little heavier wire as well. But that's the hook that I normally use. And the thing that'll throw you with bass fly hooks is that the sizing of the hooks is just from outer space. It's completely unrelated to what you're used to. If you're used to trout fly hooks or even salmon fly hooks, you know, or anything else, these bass fly hooks, I've seen hooks they call a number 10, and you put it next to a number 10 trout fly hook, and it just dwarfs it. It's like four times as long, and the gape is four times as big. It's just amazing. They've just thrown out the rules for bass fly hooks, so it's confusing.
Okay. Another follow-up on that, Doug, from the internet here. He's up in Vancouver, BC, and he wants to know, is there a particular kind of thread you use for tying spun hair bass poppers? He says, I feel like it should be a very strong thread and pulling on it hard so you can pull on it as hard as possible.
Yeah, well, amen to that. I typically use size D, as in dog, rod winding thread. It's the good rod, I think. And that's heavy stuff, because I just yank like crazy on that thread when I flare hair. And I don't want the thread to cut the hair. That's the other thing I like about that woven Gutabrod. It's a nylon, and it kind of flattens out a little bit. But, yeah, people try to use light hair thinking that they can trim closer to the hook, but the light hair doesn't compress the hair very far. So the fly falls apart, plus you can't cut very close to the hook. You use a heavy, strong thread, and it'll bury itself in the hair, and then you can trim as close as you want, plus the fly is much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So the standard is size A rod thread, and some people do have other preferences. I've heard some people like denier and some people like Kevlar, but I keep going back to the rod thread. Size A is a standard, but, you know, I actually go to D.
Okay.
Pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah. We've got Dean, in, again, off the Internet here. Dean in Westford, Massachusetts, says he's tied a couple of bass bugs, but he's not happy with them. He says it was a lot of work for little reward. How long should it take a good fly tire to complete a deer hair bass bug?
That's a real good question. Well, these have all been really good questions, to be honest. You have smart listeners.
Oh, sure we do.
Well, you know, it does take longer to tie a deer hair bug than it does your average trout fly by quite a bit. It's an involved process. The payoff is this. Deer hair tied in that way so that it's not, you know, tied at both ends where it can break, but just tied at one end, is really durable. And I have fished the same deer hair bug for as long as 10 years. One bug.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, they are. If you tie them well and with heavy thread and tie them tight, you know, they will just last and last and last. And in fact, that 10-year-old fly, when I finally put it in a box wrong and it got just crushed by the lid, and so I threw it out, but it probably would have given me a couple more years.
Mm.
So that's the payoff. First of all, nothing is quite like deer hair. You get an effect that you can't get any other way. Two, when you get better at this, you'll enjoy it. You know, I think you need to understand that it really gets fun to work with this stuff when you start, you know, getting a handle on it. And three, these flies pay for the time you put into them by their longevity.
And I'm not sure that you said before, but the tippet that you're fishing with, I'm assuming it's a heavier weight, so you're not dealing with as much break-offs as you would in trout fishing, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is, well, bass will, you know, they are dirty fighters. They're like street fighters, you know. And once in a while, you'll break a big one off, you bet. They'll get into stuff, and they'll wrap it around something and jerk it off. But on the whole, yeah, I mean, 3X would be light tippet for largemouth bass fishing, especially back in the shallows. So, yeah, you're using heavy tippet, and I don't lose bugs very often in bass fishing.
Yeah. Couple questions here, one off the Internet. What's the best way to shape deer hair poppers? And then we had another one that, you know, what tips can you give on tying deer hair bugs? So can you kind of give your best tips? Give it all up here on Ask About Fly Fishing and tell us your innermost secrets on working with hair.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you didn't leave that at just my innermost secrets. Cause
no, we don't want to know about those.
Yeah, we don't need to go there. Yeah, sure. Well, you know, at first I should probably tell your listeners, if they ever come and speak at their town and we get to shake hands, they will be surprised at what my voice really sounds like. I'm not trying to sound like one of these frogs I keep talking about. I just survived a horrible cold, and today's I'm on the upswing, so I sound real croaky. But anyway, let's see. How to trim deer hair, and the other question, well, we'll get that one first. As far as how to trim deer hair, there's the safe way and the good way. And the safe way is to use scissors. The way to get the really clean trimming is to use a double-edged razor blade, which is also a good way to trim the ends of your fingers off and, you know, give up a lot of bodily fluids. So if you ever do work with a double-edged razor, you decide to try that, my advice is take two pairs of pliers, grab the sides of the double-edged razor blade, and twist it back and forth until it breaks, then break the other end so that at least you have two blades now that have one side each that's not sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And then work with those blades with extreme caution, because you can get a bad cut from a double-edged razor blade in a heartbeat. But that double-edged razor blade will do an amazing job on deer hair.
Okay.
And let's see, what's the other question?
Just general tips on, you know, tying deer hair that you could help people out with.
Okay, well, there was a good one right there.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, the other one, I'll give you another good one. You can learn to spin hair, and if, you know, with the fly tire's personality, if we know it can be done and we see somebody do it especially, we just have to do it or we can't sleep at night. But once you've gotten that out of your system, I really don't spin hair very often anymore. Usually I just do it at a show because somebody asked me to. And it is fun, but I think I get results that are at least as good, if not better, by simply holding the hair atop the shank, pushing it down around the shank, taking two turns of thread, and then pulling tightly down on the thread with the thread coming towards me, then a little more away from me, a little towards me, and a little away from me till I get it as tight as it can get. And I get great results, and the hair, when you spin it, the tips tend to get caught up, but when you do it this way, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, other than that, just be, you know, just practice and get used to using a hair packing tool. If you don't pack the hair, you're not going to like what you get.
Now, these are things I assume are on your DVD.
Yeah, and in the book, yeah. And hair packing simply means that you have a tool that comes over the shank and then comes up against the hair, and you push the hair back. Each time you tie in a bunch, you get it secured, and then you push it back in the previous bunch, and that increases the density greatly.
As opposed to a hair stacker, you're talking about a packer.
Right, whole different thing. That just evens the tips for tying trout flies and things.
Right, right.
Yeah, hair pack or hair compressing tool.
Okay. Let's see here. Let's talk a little bit about, because we've only got about 5 minutes left here, so we've got way more questions tonight than we're going to get answered here. But let's talk a little bit about some strategies in fishing here. Get off the bugs for a minute here. First of all, what's the best way to find, you know, a big largemouth, you know, in still water? Where's the best place to look for them, and how do you find them?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't claim to be a big fish specialist. That's never been my bent. You know, some people, it's all about the big fish. I love big fish as a kind of, the icing on the cake now and then. I'm real satisfied with medium-sized fish and sometimes real satisfied with small fish. But I will say this, with largemouth, it seems like if you're going to catch the bigger fish, and this is true at most fish, trout included, you're going to catch them by going after them in the depths where they really live. So, you know, all that popper stuff, once in a while you'll get a big fish, but you're much more likely to get one by going down after them. And that means, you know, if there's a bunch of weeds and off the deep end of the weeds where bed stops, it's 8 feet deep, your best shot is to be with your fly down about 7 feet on that edge instead of a hair bug on the surface. And if you get out into the lake where there's some structure down there and you use a fast sinking line, you know, that's another place. I mean, the thing we forget about big fish is that they have to feed, too, and they'll go where the food is, but they don't like to expose themselves to predators. That's partly how they got to be big. So, you know, it's not impossible. I've caught big bass, what I would call big bass, in pretty shallow water. Sometimes really shallow water, but that stuff's going to mostly happen when they get up in the shallow water, especially. That's going to be when the light is low, and most typically it's going to be in the morning and the evening, like sunset and, you know, before sunrise. The other time is in the spring, and again in the fall, and that's because spring bass are hungry. They've been pretty much dormant through the winter and not feeding much. And then in the fall, they're kind of preparing for the winter. So spring, fall, and deep, those would be the main things.
What about time of day? You know, they always say, you know, you want a big brown trout, you go after them at dusk or after dark. You know, that's when you get your big browns. Is there any time of day issue with largemouth?
Oh, yeah. I mean, time of season is a big one, too, because in the spring when the water's cool and the fish are thinking about staging for spawning and all that, the fishing can be good right on through the day. But when you get into the heat of summer, then the middle of the day is usually too bright and a little too warm for their comfort. And so if you don't have a good overcast day, that can help a lot. But, you know, in the midsummer, in the normal season, midday can be kind of slow. And morning can be good, and I think for largemouth, really, you can't top sunset. That can be amazing.
Yeah, so similar to the brown trout, too. Just based upon the idea of cover and not being exposed to predators, that's always the key, I think.
I think that's a lot of it. Yeah, fish, you know, fish are pretty simple on the whole. They're just trying to survive and get enough food to eat, and, you know, that dictates a lot of their actions.
What about, and I'm just kind of lumping some of these here because we're running out of time, but I know there were several questions about water temperatures for largemouth. Can you shed any light on whether it's seasonal temperatures or daily temperatures that push the fish into one area or another?
You know, that's something that off the top of my head I couldn't tell you what are ideal water temperatures for largemouth bass, but what I know from my experience and from my reading as well, but which supports it, you know, it's kind of like what I was saying a moment ago. In the spring, the fish are looking for the warmer water because most of the water is too cold for them. So they're going to go into shallow flats that, you know, catch a lot of sunlight and can warm up faster than deeper water. and they're just looking around for that warmer water. And then you get to summer, and they're kind of trying to avoid the warmer water, so they're going deep during the day a lot of times. And then in the fall, when the water's starting to get cold, not quite sure how to interpret fall. I'm not sure what to say about fall, so I better not say anything.
Yeah, okay. Let's see here. We've got time for one more question, maybe. Oh, yeah, and there were a couple questions about this. Tandem rigs with fishing for bass, do you use those, and are they effective? And if so, how do you use them?
That's something that I have experimented with, and I like that question because I haven't met very many bass fly fishers who've done that, even though double fly rigs are pretty common in trout fishing. But, you know, bass, I said it before, they're kind of underrated. You know, if you catch them in the spring when they're thinking about spawning, well, they become idiots just like everybody else does when they're thinking about that. Same with bluegill, you know. But trout are morons when they're ready to spawn, so I don't know why that surprises anybody. But I have a great respect for trout, but I have it for bass, too. And there are times when I have seen bass just come up one after another, and no matter what I did, they wouldn't hit my big hair bug. You know, they'd come right up and just about touch it with their nose, and they'd go, not today. But if I tied a little fly, and the one I was using was my SMP, which is that little bluegill or panfish fly I mentioned before, I put that a couple of feet or a foot and a half of tip it off the bend so that when the bug moves, you know, that just kind of jerks up and swims back down and flutters its wing a little bit. And they'd come up, look at the bug, go down, and the next thing you know, the bug gets jerked backwards because on the way down they saw that little SMP. And that smaller size, just like with trout, sometimes a smaller fly can be more convincing than a bigger fly to a fish.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do that, you bet.
You do. Okay, great. Well, that's about all we got time for here tonight, Skip. So I know there's still more questions here that we didn't get answered, but it's pretty typical, and we just want to thank everybody for sending in the ones they did send in and apologize that we didn't get to them, but tried to cover as much ground as possible. But stick around here for a few more minutes. We're going to be giving away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine and that Skip's DVD on the Art of Tying a Bass Fly, which I know everybody listening would like to get, courtesy of Amato Books. So stick with us for a few more minutes, and we'll be giving away those prizes. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and give us your feedback. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away our prizes, and we're going to do our drawings first. And our first drawing will be for the membership for the Federation of Fly Fishers, a wonderful prize to receive. And if you want to know more about the Federation, just go to their website at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you can learn all about Federation and see what they're up to. Great educational organization. So our winner there is Robert Otten. Robert Otten, and he's in New Jersey. Congratulations, Robert. We will be contacting you by email to let you know and get your information so that we can get you this membership started. So congratulations, Robert. Second thing we're going to give away is the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And if you want to know more about this magazine, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com, a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada, lots of great how-to articles and lots of great photography. And our winner for that is Bob Mackey in Idaho. So congratulations, Bob. And same thing, we'll get in touch with you by email so that we can get your information, get that subscription started. Now we got to give away Skip Your DVD, and
right.
Yeah, so I got to clear my queue here and make sure nobody is trying to guess it before I even ask the question, because that's happened before. Anticipation, see, you know,
that's clairvoyance, I think.
They're trying to beat the system. Okay, so I've cleared my queue, and the question is, when Skip and I, we were talking about poppers, he mentioned a hard body popper, a foam popper, and a deer hair popper. What was Skip's reasoning for using deer hair? Why did he think that a deer hair popper might be a better choice? That's the question, okay? Think I phrased that okay, Skip?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll see what kind of answers we get here, and I'll let you help me out, Skip, and see if we got who has the right one.
Okay.
Well, the first one, he just answered, he just gave me all the three that we had. That's not what I was looking for. Everybody thought that I was asking what the three are, and that's not what I was asking. I was asking why the deer here is maybe a better choice. Okay, I think we might have one here. I just passed a bunch of them, Skip, that said, gave me the three, you know, the three popper types. So
I thought you were clear.
Yeah. No, they probably typed it in before I asked the question and then pressed go.
Probably.
Yeah. So anyway, we got one here that says, deer hair is mushy and stays in the bass's mouth. Is that close?
That's close enough for me.
Okay.
I don't like to think of it as mushy, but I can accept mushy.
Okay. But the idea was the softness in the mouth and more like real food, right?
Yep, I think so.
Okay, so we'll give it to Dean Wormel in Westford, Massachusetts. Dean, you just got Skip's DVD. So, Dean, send us your, either you can use the same text box, send us your email address as well as your physical shipping address so that we can get a motto to send that DVD out to you. Or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. And either way, we'll get it, and we'll take care of you, Dean. So congratulations, and I'm sure you'll get great benefit out of Skip's DVD. So
enjoy, Dean.
So, yeah, and Skip, hey, thanks for being on the show with us. It was a pleasure to talk with you. I'm glad you toughed it out with your getting over your cold here, and maybe next time we have an interview, you'll be a whole different person, voice-wise anyway, right?
Yeah, my brain's working okay. My voice is just a little strange. Yeah, I think you'll get the same person otherwise.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed this thoroughly. Thank you so much, Roger, for inviting me.
Oh, no, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure, and I'm sure we all learned a lot. I know I did, so thanks for being on the show.
You bet.
Our next broadcast will be on December 15th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we'll interview Trapper Rudd, and our topic for the show will be Fly Fishing Micronesia, a fly fishing adventure. Trapper Rudd is always going to somewhere exotic in search of new places to fly fish. Putting together a trip to a place like Micronesia is no easy task, and the results are always unknown. Join us to find out how a trip like this comes together and the initial concept to hooking up with new exotic species like Indo-Pacific tarpon, permit, bonefish, and giant trevally. So we'll have that show ready for you on December 15th. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, the World Champion Bass on a Fly Fishing Tournament, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673 extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.